Please continue eating, and we will begin the program now. I'm Mel Cusin, the director of the series, and I'm welcome you all here. I think this audience of well-read Dallas citizens will agree that we are in tumultuous times, probably the country's most challenging since this speaker series began 18 years ago. We have serious questions, like, what are America's long-term needs and goals relating to the world, including trade and strategic relationships with our allies? What is likely to take place elsewhere on the globe that will affect or even threaten America's security? Tough questions that need answering if the United States is to maintain its preeminent position as a leader of the free world. To propose answers to these questions is our speaker today, Dr. Charles Kupchan. In my opinion, Charlie, as he is called by his colleagues and friends, is the country's top authority on what are the elements of sound U.S. foreign policy and how they relate to the rest of the world. Dr. Kupchan is professor of international affairs at the School of Foreign Policy and the Department of Government at Georgetown University. But wait, he comes to us not from Georgetown, but from the National Security Council, where he was taken to be special assistant to the president and senior director for European operations for the past 12 months, and where he worked until a week ago Friday. He's literally hot off the griddle from the country's center of national security planning. Dr. Kupchan's undergraduate degree is from Harvard, with both his master's and PhD from Oxford. In addition to faculty at Georgetown, he has taught at Princeton and at Oxford. When I was preparing his introduction, I discovered the list of his university service and publications, academically referred to as his vitae, ran to 13 pages. One of his books, The End of the American Era, U.S. Foreign Policy and the Geopolitics of the 21st Century, had translated editions in Belgium, Bulgaria, China, France, Germany, Greece, Italy, Japan, the Netherlands, South Korea, and Russia. Reviewers who raved about the book included Henry Kissinger. Dr. Kupchan's latest book is No One World, The West, The Rising Rest, and the Coming Global Turn. One reviewer wrote this: Dr. Kupchan sees a world in which Western values are no longer dominant. That's a debatable point, but one that is cogently argued by one of the keenest observers of international politics. That reviewer was Francis Fukuyama, author of The End of History and The Last Man. Enough about his background and his work. To the man himself, let's give a big Dallas welcome to Dr. Charles Kupchan.
Thank you very much, Mel, for the warm welcome, and to Jim and Margo and Joel and others for the warm hospitality here in Dallas. I think this is at least my third visit to this group. It may be even my fourth. I come in part because I always learn a lot from you and enjoy the conversation, but mainly I come to pick up my regular allotment of Mel's, what's it called, chili spice mix. Yes, I fly all the way out here to get two packets of chili spice mix. And it's very good. I want a commission, okay? Yeah. Where to begin? This is probably the most perplexing moment in American history in many of our lifetimes. I've been in this business for around 30 years, and I can't think of any other moment when I have been as perplexed by what's going on in the United States as well as abroad, and in which, quite honestly, I am as worried as I am today about the trajectory of American politics and of global affairs. So what I'd like to do is give you some sense as to where I think we are headed. And I want to do four things. One is to give you a quick description of how I see the global landscape, what the major sources of instability are, what the residual forces of stability are. Then I want to give you quick evaluations of the Obama administration and the Trump administration, although that will obviously be very early and provisional because we are only less than 2 weeks in. And then I'll end with a few comments about what's next and what I think our responsibilities are as citizens of the United States. In terms of the current global landscape, I can't think of any moment since the end of World War II where we face as many potential sources of instability as we face today. The European project, which we have a role in building, the Marshall Plan, NATO alongside the European Union, that project is in question. The Brits have already decided to get out. It's conceivable that Marine Le Pen of the National Front could win the French election. If she wins and pulls France out of the European Union, I don't think it can survive. That project of European integration is one of the most radical, revolutionary, successful accomplishments of our time, because we spent most of our history either fighting Europeans or going across the Atlantic to prevent Europeans from killing each other. And now you drive from France to Germany and you don't stop, you don't change money, you don't see a border patrol, you don't see a tank. That border is geopolitically meaningless. That's a miracle. And if that goes away and Europe unravels and Europe's borders and nation states comes back to life, our center of gravity for the last 60, 70 years comes unglued. And having spent the last 3 years sitting in the White House trying to help manage American foreign policy, I have to say I'm struck by how little the world has changed from the last time I was in the White House, which was under President Clinton in his first term, 92, 93, 94, when the world was still very Atlanticist. I would have thought that going back in 2014, we would have built new partnerships with Brazil, Argentina, Indonesia, Turkey, Indonesia, and China. The problem is that when you pick up the phone and you call the Chinese or you call the Indonesians or you call the Brazilians and you say, hey, we need help. We've got an Ebola crisis. What are you prepared to commit to the counter-ISIL coalition? Are you ready to step up to the plate? They hang up the phone. And in the end of the day, when you need to get something done in the world, we're still left picking up the phone and calling Berlin, Paris, London, Brussels, Warsaw. And that's because those emerging powers are not yet in a place where they are prepared to step up to the plate and contribute public goods. with some exceptions. But as a consequence, if we lose our European partner, if we let the Atlantic core unravel, the world is going to be a very lonely place for the United States and for everyone else. The Middle East is coming unglued. There is conflict or potential conflict across the region. There are only a handful of real, what you might call, nation states in the region, and by that I mean countries that were not cobbled together by departing European powers. And they include Egypt, Turkey, and Iran, countries with long histories and a sense of national identity and national cohesion. And none of those countries are in very good shape today. Turkey, our NATO ally for many decades, is experiencing a level of political centralization, I guess, to put it nicely, an internal ethnic division that is quite worrying. And it is to some extent throwing in its lot with the Russians when it comes to the crisis in Syria in ways that may have long-term implications for Turkey's participation in a broader Western community. Russia is arguably a greater problem for the United States today than it was during the Cold War, because in the Cold War, we knew what we were up against. The Red Army, a lot of ballistic missiles, and we sat here and glared at them, and they sat there and glared at us, and not much else happened. Now, they play a much more sophisticated and difficult game. They use military force only in places where they enjoy natural asymmetries, as in Georgia and Ukraine. Georgia and Ukraine are very far from here. We are not going to go to war for Ukraine. The Russians know that, and that's why they are willing to insert forces and cause trouble and keep those countries off balance as a way of keeping them out of our sphere of influence, out of joining the Euro-Atlantic world. The hybrid tactics, the cyber tactics, the intervention in our election, they are all over Europe. They buy newspapers, they buy NGOs, they hire what they call trolls, which are Frenchmen or Serbians or Poles, and they get them to go out on social media and say things and write things that are lies, but that end up eating away at centrist and fact-based politics in those societies. They played a role in funding the Leave campaign. They fund the National Front in France. They fund parties that are attempting to prevent Montenegro from entering NATO. And they're very good at what they do. We need to do a better job of playing that game and countering them when it comes to narrative, when it comes to the battle over facts and ideas. China, a rising power, much more cautious in many respects than Russia, much more traditional than Russia, but nonetheless, if you stretch the time horizon out, let's say 10 years rather than 3 to 5 years, a country that is going to take its place as a major world power. And we have some very difficult decisions looming on the horizon about what we do when they reach that stage. When we began to reach that stage, we unfurled and began to operate according to the Monroe Doctrine, which basically said, in this hemisphere, we call the shots. They are in the process of making a similar kind of statement about the Western Pacific, and that's why they are now building air bases and naval bases and arms depots on offshore islands. And by offshore, I don't mean 50 miles offshore. I mean hundreds of miles offshore near the Philippines, near other countries that would allow them to project power well into the Western Pacific. As that happens, we have tough choices to make about how we are going to respond. And then finally, we've got a whole host of other national security threats that are of a more non-traditional type. Climate change and what it means when major countries go underwater or major coastal regions sink. We've got a new level of cyber warfare going on. I think it was yesterday that the Czech Republic announced that some state is taking down their networks. Every day it seems to be some other country that is dealing with a cyber offensive. And part of the equation is getting the technology to deal with that, both defensively and offensively. But we're in sort of uncharted water when it comes to figuring out how to play that game. Whether we want to go down the road of using that as a toolkit. Because obviously if we go too far, we may be in a situation in which countries start taking down one another's electrical grids or stock markets or internet. And so we need to be very, very careful about the rules of the road when it comes to cyber warfare. The good news is that the world is more interdependent than it's ever been, that globalization has been enormously successful in building middle-class societies around the world, that interdependence generally means that we are not in a zero-sum international economic arena, and that there is a very strong premium put on collaboration, especially coming from the private sector as well as from the public sector, because of the economic stakes associated with a globalization that has taken place on the scale and on the scope that we've seen today. Secondly, despite what I said about China and Russia, we still live in a world in which there really is no great power rivalry of the sort that we have seen throughout most of history. There's jockeying, there's an undercurrent of conflict and rivalry, but we are nowhere near having to face the prospect of major conflict with another great power. That's a historical luxury, and let's hope it stays that way. Let's hope that the worst wars that we have to deal with are in places like Syria and Libya. Because in the end of the day, they do not pose direct and immediate threats to the physical territorial security of the United States. If we again face war with Russia or if we face war with China, it's a different story. Third, we, I think, face no major ideological rifts of the sort that we have faced throughout many eras of history. The North Koreans are still out there. The Cubans are still, quote unquote, a socialist country. The Chinese call themselves communist and they're ruled by the Communist Party. But China is basically a Wild West capitalist country. And in that respect, we do not see the fundamental ideological dividing lines that for much of American history we have had to deal with. And that's generally good news. And it means that countries like Iran, like China, like Russia, that want to play in international markets need to watch their behavior because they know that if they don't, they can get punished. And that's why the sanctions that have been imposed against Russia are actually a pretty strong tool of trying to encourage Putin to play by the rules. Because even though he doesn't have a democratic populace to which he's accountable, he has vested interests in the military, among oligarchs, among the security services that depend heavily on investment, on trade, to keep them happy. So we are tethered together in a way that is I think, in the end, a source of stability. Final point. We still live in what is a rules-based international system. The order that the United States took the lead in crafting and then defending and pushing out after World War II, that order still exists. It's an order that's based upon free trade, upon liberal values and principles of dignity, of human rights, upon the spread of democracy and the rule of law, upon decision-making through institutions and multilateralism and not through countries going it alone. But as I'll come to in a second, that order is, I think, today as threatened, as fragile, as vulnerable as it has been since the end of World War II. Let me make a couple of comments about how I understand what's happening domestically in this country, and then segue to quick assessments of the Obama years and then what appears to be taking shape under President Trump. You know, I think that that when it comes to foreign policy, we have gone through two marked turning points. The first turning point was around 1994. And I picked 1994 because that's when Congress shifted hands and we began to see the centrist bipartisan foundations of American foreign policy crack. And we saw Democrats and Republicans generally move further apart in a way that hollowed our bipartisan center. In general, Republicans became the party of power. Democrats became the party of institutions and multilateralism. But, and this is very important, Democrats and Republicans differed about means. They did not differ about ends. In the end of the day, the Republican Party, including what you might call neoconservatives, wanted to defend the same rules-based international order that Democrats wanted to defend. And that's why that rules-based order, whether George W. Bush was president or whether Clinton or whether Obama was president, was in good shape. Again, we differed on partisan lines about means, but we agreed in the end of the day about what we were up to as a nation when it came to the ends of our foreign policy. What's happened today in the second inflection point, and why it's a much more concerning inflection point, is that we no longer agree on the ends. And I think that what has happened in this country is that we've been living in a domestic society in which the various constituents of American society all bought into and supported that broader international order that Republicans and Democrats alike supported. It was good for them. There was inequality, but everybody's boat was floating upward. What seems to have happened today is that a reasonably large swath of American society no longer believes that that system works for them. They believe that globalization has led to winners and to losers, and that they're the losers. And as a consequence, there is now a strong, I wouldn't say majority, because popular vote went one way, the Electoral College went another way, but close to a majority of the American populace that is now saying, I don't think that order works for me. I don't see how this is going to lead to a situation for me in which I can pursue the American dream. And at least for now, the populist wing of the Republican Party has won out over the establishment wing of the Republican Party, and that populist wing is no longer supportive of that broader international order that Democrats and Republicans alike have been defending since Pearl Harbor. Whether this is a passing moment or whether this is the beginning of a foreign policy of a sort that we haven't seen, or maybe we've seen it, but it wasn't in the modern era. We'd have to go back to the 19th century or maybe the 1930s to find something similar. It's too soon to tell. But clearly, a combination of job loss, of immigration and of terrorism has led to a revolt among a substantial portion of electorates in Western industrialized democracies. Here, I think it's more about job loss and a little bit less about immigration. In Europe, it's a little bit more about immigration and a little bit less about job loss, in part because Europe's safety nets are more robust. But in the end of the day, economic discontent and identity politics are leading to a situation in which there is a populist upsurge of a sort that we have not seen in the post-World War II era. And if it were only happening here, I would be less worried. The problem is, it's happening everywhere. And the fact is that there are two countries that are primarily responsible for shaping the modern world in which we live. Those two countries are the United Kingdom and the United States. Beginning in 1815, it was Britain under Pax Britannica that embarked us down the road of creating a rules-based international order based upon democratic and liberal principles. That lasted until roughly World War I. Then we went into an interregnum in which nobody was really calling the shots and all hell broke loose, and then Pax Americana began. So we've really been in a very long run in which either the United States or the United Kingdom has been the main provider of international order. Well, guess what? The Brits just retired, and the United States has just gone through an election in which it said, we are not sure that we like this order. And as I said, there are elections upcoming in France, in Germany, in the Netherlands, maybe in Italy, because Renzi has just fallen, because he lost a referendum. We don't know where those referenda are going to go. But what we do know is after being relatively sure that the Brits would vote against Brexit and being damn sure that Donald Trump would not be the next president of the United States, we ought to be very cautious about making predictions about what's coming around the corner. So that's kind of where we are. Let me just say a few things about my former boss and then our current president. You know, I think that, let me start off by saying where I thought Obama excelled and then a few things about where I thought he made some missteps. In terms of where he excelled, I think he is one of the most methodical, deliberative, considered, cautious presidents that we've ever had. He did his homework. He came to meetings more prepared than any other human being I've ever met. He stayed up till 2 o'clock every night eating almonds and reading his briefing books. And he brought remarkable intelligence, discipline, and decency to the Oval Office. I don't care whether you're an Obama supporter or Obama detractor. I don't think you can take issue with the reality that he is one of the most decent people to occupy that office. He does not have a corrupt bone in his body. And I think that Americans of all political stripes will come to miss the fact that a person of that level of integrity and quality occupied that office for 8 years. And I think it gave the president a moral authority in this country and abroad that served us well. Secondly, he was very much a team player. And we live in a world in which no country can do virtually anything on its own. And that's because if you just look at the host of problems and challenges that I outlined at the beginning of my remarks, they are all problems that can be solved only through collective action. Whether it's Ebola, or fighting ISIL, or dealing with the rise of China, or dealing with cyber warfare, or pushing back against hybrid tactics from Russia, we need a large international grouping if we're going to be successful. Climate change is probably the most clear example of that. And I think that President Obama did a very good job of building those coalitions. And I would just sort of highlight one relationship in particular that was more important than any other relationship in the world, and that was the relationship between the United States and Germany. The president enjoyed a friendship with Merkel that was unlike any other relationship that he had. I and my staff talked to, either on the phone, emailed, the video, to the German chancellery, I would say every day. I was at a dinner a few weeks ago in Germany and happened to be sitting across from the German National Security Advisor, someone named Christoph Heusgen. And this subject came up. And I just said to Christoph, this was a Saturday night, over the last 12 hours, how many emails have you and I exchanged? And the answer was over a dozen. And that level of coordination, that kind of close collaboration between the United States and Germany, between the United States and other powers, is key. And I only hope that the incoming team goes out and tries to replicate that level of international cooperation, because otherwise we simply aren't going to be able to function in a globalized, interdependent world. Third point, I think Obama was was the first president in the post-war era to raise difficult questions about setting priorities and trying to get us out of a world in which we had probably bitten off more than we could chew. In the end of the day, he did not get us out of the Middle East. He tried his best to get U.S. troops out of Iraq and Afghanistan, but Iraq and Afghanistan would not let us go. But I do think he asked very tough questions about it. He probably moved too slowly to get back into Iraq when it was clear that ISIS, or ISIL, whatever you want to call it, was expanding. But I do think that he really is the first president that has begun to basically recognize that we no longer have the resources, ability to enforce Pax Americana in the way that we've done it for the last 60, 70 years. And just as a quick data point, during a lot of the Cold War, we, alongside our European allies, represented about 75 to 80% of GDP. We are now collectively down to about 45% of collective GDP. And that number is going to continue to decline. So that means that in a world in which power is diffusing, we can't run the world, we can't protect the world, unless we've got partners by our side who are holding their fair share of the burden. Finally, he, I think, helped avert a global economic crisis, which we were on the cusp of when he took office. And I think he had the courage to begin to unwind long-standing adversarial relationships that did not make a lot of sense, Cuba in particular. Where do I think he fell short, or where do I think one could most legitimately target criticism? One would be that he was in some ways deliberative and cautious to a fault. And as a consequence, we ended up in a policy that you might call no man's land on occasion. Syria is probably a pretty good example of that, where we sided with the moderate opposition against Assad, but didn't really make the tough call to do enough to defeat Assad, especially after he had the backing of Iran, Russia, and other parties, nor were we quite ready to let the opposition go and let the war proceed toward its natural conclusion. And I think in there are cases, Libya comes to mind, Afghanistan comes to mind, where at least from my judgment, we got stuck in the middle because of the very cautious, deliberative nature, rather than going one way or the other. And in the end of the day, presidents sometimes just need to jump into the deep end of the pool and live with the consequences. And I'm not sure that he did that as often as we might like. A second is, I think that caution also led him to be fearful of escalation, which is generally a good thing. But I do fear that there are times in which we should have been willing to live with the risks of escalation because it was the right thing to do. One particular historical episode that comes to mind was the red line in Syria, in which the president has said, if he uses chemical weapons, we're going to whack him. He used chemical weapons, we didn't whack him. And I think there was a cost to American credibility and the sense in the region that the United States would, in the end of the day, do what it said it would do. Finally, and this will serve as the bridge to discussing Mr. Trump, even though I think the president was quite aware of the downside or the dark side of globalization, we, and by we I mean everyone in this room, everyone in the United States for that matter, haven't done enough to deal with the discontent that exists out there in Middle America. We know that there's a problem. We know that Americans in Middle America, especially working class Americans with lower education, have been living with stagnant or declining wages for decades. We just don't know what the hell to do about it. And that, I think, is why we are now living with a political system in which the discontent of that grouping, of that constituency, has made itself known. Turning to President Trump, let me begin with a few hopeful comments and then a few concerning comments. As far as the hopeful comments, building on what I just said, we do have a problem. The UK has a problem. France has a problem. And that is that there are large numbers of workers, largely from the manufacturing sector, that are unhappy. And we ignore that or fail to address it at our peril, because if we don't address it, it could compromise our democratic institutions for generations to come. And so the fact that the President of the United States is dedicating himself to addressing that problem is a good thing. That problem needs to be front and center. If anyone tells you that they have an answer to that problem, they're lying. Because we don't have an answer to that problem. I don't know, you don't know, what the average American in Wichita or Peoria or in rural America is going to be doing in 2025 to earn a living wage. I think there are answers to that question, but we just don't have them yet. We don't know how to get from here to there. We need to be able to get from here to there. Secondly, I think the president is right that our allies have to do more precisely because of those numbers that I just gave you. If we and our allies are now 45-ish percent of GDP and the world around us is changing and we need to defend that rules-based order, then our allies need to do much more to help us do that. I don't think that President Trump should say, if you're a NATO ally and you're not spending 2% of GDP, I'm not going to defend you. But I do think he should say, you need to step up to the plate and you need to contribute your fair share. That is a legitimate argument. And then finally, I do think that in some ways, in the vein of President Obama, he is taking us back to a more, what I would call, solvent definition of the American interest. We got caught in a trap of American exceptionalism in which we were going out into the world and trying to turn Afghanistan and Iraq into Ohio. That was a fool's errand. And we need to be much more hard-headed about what fights we pick, what our goals are when we pick those fights, because we are no longer flush. We need to husband our resources. We need to have a more hard-headed and realist view of what our interests are. Now, the president may be going too far in that definition of interest, but I think it's a conversation that we as Americans need to have. Now, on the other hand, what leaves me most concerned? I would say three things. The first is that perhaps because of the predilections of his electoral base, it appears that President Trump not only does not want to defend that rules-based order that we expended blood and treasure to erect, but he wants to tear it down in calling for protective tariffs, in canceling the Trans-Pacific Partnership and TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade Investment, in closing our borders to refugees, in favoring illiberal leaders like Putin and fighting with elected democratic leaders like President Hollande and Prime Minister of Australia. He seems to be putting us on a political trajectory that is, to be frank, unrecognizable. In the hotel from which I just came, thank you to the Hilton for the hospitality, there was a trade conference going on. It was called Imagine. I don't even know what it was about. But there was clearly a high-tech component, and the room, the lobbies were teeming and buzzing and full of all kinds of people, and the people sitting behind the laptops were white and South Asian and Hispanic. That's the America that is our future. Many of you probably have similar stories. My story is that my grandparents came from Ukraine in the 1920s. Ellis Island, no money, opened a store in the Bronx called Kupchin's Appetizing. My father spent his childhood with his hands smelling like pickles, because that's what he did every afternoon. And then he went out and said, I need this like a hole in the head. He got a PhD from Columbia and he became a chemistry professor. His son grew up in an academic family and went and got a PhD in international relations and spent the last 3 years in the White House. All the Kupchins who didn't leave Ukraine in 1922 are dead because they were killed by the Nazis. Right? This is the American story. This is who we are. If we try to turn this country into something else, we will not be America anymore. And I think we need to raise our voices if the president tries to take us in a direction that is inconsistent with our fundamental values. It's who we are. Second worry I have is that even though he is asking the right question, that is, what are average Americans going to do to earn a living wage, I fear that he does not have the right answer. Is he going to save America's manufacturing sector by slapping a 20% tariff on Mexico? Is he going to save the American economy by pulling out of TPP and TTIP? My own estimation, based on my training and my experience, is the opposite is going to happen. American, the cost of American goods will rise at a much higher pace than the cost than American wages. Yes, there will be a manufacturing plant here or there that stays open, or that returns from Mexico or returns from Malaysia, but they will be the exception and not the rule. And we will lose our ability to help craft an open international liberal order because we're not there. We don't have a seat at the table. We're not present. And in the end of the day, not to show any disrespect for our manufacturing sector, because it is part of a fundamental foundation of American economy, we are not going to be great for the foreseeable future just by building good washing machines and air conditioners. I hope we build the best washing machines and air conditioners, but we need to make sure that we also have the best universities and that we are bringing in the best minds, the best chemists from Iran, the best software developers from India, because that's where our future lies. It's in innovation, it's in entrepreneurship, and trying to take the country back to the 1950s or the 19th century is not a recipe for success. The final comment I would make, and in some ways it is what most concerns me, is I fear that at least for now we have a government in Washington that is not making decisions based on facts and analysis. We currently do not live in a fact-based society. When President Trump rolled out the immigration order last week, I do not believe that it was based on a careful consideration of the economic implications or the security implications. It was based upon a calculation about appealing to his base and playing identity politics and politics of emotion. That is not a good idea. Yes, all politicians in the end of the day need to worry about their political base. But if we end up a country that pursues policies not because they make sense from an analytic perspective, but because they are about disrupting the establishment, we are really going to be in hot soup. Now, there are people around him who are professionals, who are seasoned. One of them comes from this community, the Secretary of State. I would put the Secretary of Defense in that camp, and there are others. The key question that I think we have to ask right now is, will he listen to them? Will they have influence? I'm guessing that both of them are accomplished enough that if they don't have influence and they are not listened to, they will walk. Neither of them needs another line on the resume. But this, I think, is a key question. There are very talented people there. So far, he has not listened to them. Final comment before I wrap up. My fear, kind of pulling these threads together, is that President Trump's policies will not work because they are not based upon a thought for consideration of how to go from here to there. They are based on a different political calculation, which is really about disruption. And if that's the case, then his voter base is going to be increasingly upset because they will not be given the quality of life that they are hoping for, which will then force him to recede even more deeply into the politics of deception and the divorce of the American government from being a fact-based institution. We need to prevent that from happening. And I think as citizens, it is our responsibility to exercise our voices, to encourage our institutions that provide checks and balances to operate as fully and openly as possible, I don't know who he's going to listen to. He's already called the press the most dishonest people on earth. I don't think he's going to listen to me. I'm tainted. So I guess the one final thought I would have is those of you who are in the room, those of you in the room who happen to be Republicans, you may be the only people he's going to listen to. So if you're concerned about the way we are heading, I would encourage you to call Ryan or call McConnell or call whomever your local congressperson is and speak up, because we are at a critical crossroads in the country. And I'm, in the end of the day, an optimist because our fundamentals are good. We still have the best universities in the country. We still are an immigrant society. We are bringing the best and brightest from abroad. In the end of the day, if you look at our demographics are of younger people who want the country to be more open, more nimble, more diverse. So I think when everything shakes out, that America, the America that we've been living in, will, in the end of the day, survive. But we're going to have to fight for it. Thank you.
So thank you very much, Dr. Kupchan. Our usual format is this, that we will take a question or two to go to 1:30, and then you'll stay till about 2 for informal discussion around the podium. But we also are going to have a slight change because Mel Kuzin has a statement to make as well. So let me take one or two questions. Do I see any questions up here? I need to see the hands so that we know. All right, there we go. Let's take your question, if you'll wait for the microphone. Are there another question? We have time for one more question. Okay, we'll go over there to our German professor. And if you make your questions as short as possible. Take the microphone, please, sir. Microphone. Thank you.
I've had the pleasure of listening to you the last time you were in Dallas, and I left optimistic in every sense. Today, I've felt a pessimism in your approach, which is
regrettable. I've got to have a question.
I don't have a question. I just wanted to make the point that it was
We're not going to do that today. Okay. We really are so short of time. Thank you.
I'm wondering, what advice would you give to those employees at the State Department who signed the letter of dissent? Should they stay in the State Department and hope to work to make things better and serve the American people, or would you recommend they find employment elsewhere?
For now, I would encourage all federal employees to stay because they have an enormous amount of expertise and capability, and one hopes that after the president and his inner circle have been around for a while, that they open the circle to professionals. I think that right now the president is running the U.S. government like a family-run business, and you can't run a huge organization that way. All of my staff, my office is about a dozen people. I'm the only one who left. I was the only political appointee. Everyone else in the European Affairs Directorate is a career appointee. I have asked them all to stay, and they're there, they're toiling away, they're doing their best. But we also had conversations about when they would have to leave, and I said to them, if it turns out that you are being asked on a regular basis to do things or say things that violate your most fundamental values, then you will have to quit. I don't know if it will come to that point, but if I were speaking to a State Department employee, I would say the same thing. I would say, stay there, give it at least 6 months, and see where this goes.
Okay, Larry, you got the last question. Larry Steinberg.
You mentioned
Larry, if you'd wait for the microphone, we've got such a large audience.
You mentioned that you had a dozen emails with Germany every day. I'm just curious, what do you coordinate that you do in 12 emails every day? Just generally, nothing confidential, naturally, or
sure.
security-wise, but...
In general, everything. Because the Germans have emerged as the most important player in Europe, which is a radical shift. It used to be London, but over the last 15 years or so, Europe's center of gravity shifted to Berlin. And Merkel right now she's it. Hollande is finished. We don't know who's going to be the next president of France. Merkel is really left holding the bag. And the president spoke to her last Saturday. I understand it was a reasonable conversation, a constructive conversation. But during the 3 years that I was there, it was that dialogue between Washington and Berlin that kept everything together. The president and Merkel would get on the phone or video conference, and they would discuss Ukraine, they would discuss ISIL, they would discuss Ebola, whatever it might be. She would socialize that issue within the European Union. The president would socialize it bilaterally with others, and then we would build a consensus. That's the way diplomacy works in this world, and I hope that it's preserved. In that particular instance, if I recall correctly, we were drafting a G7 statement on the situation in Ukraine and going back and forth with different versions of that language.
Charlie. Dr. Kupchin, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Stay up here. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I want to choose my words very carefully here. I think Dr. Kupchin did an exceptional job of outlining some of the challenges that we're faced in the United States, and there's also no doubt where he stands. The World Affairs Council, and I said this, some of you heard me on Monday speak, we do believe in global engagement. We believe, frankly, many of us, in an open trade policy. But I want you to know, too, that although I greatly respect and admire what you said, we will also do our best to bring in speakers that will present a different view, and that's what we do here. So you may send me emails this afternoon, pro and con, but we are looking for all views. In fact, I was thinking a little while ago this morning, and I'm going to ask our chairman to help us, want to send out letters next week to all of the ranking and leaders in both the Republican and Democratic Party on the main committees to give them a place at our podium. So again, Dr. Kupchin, thank you so much for being here. If you can wait for two more minutes, I know Mel Kuzin would like to say a few words.
By September of 1999, I had conceived a kind of a unique idea for a speaker series that would raise Dallas citizens' awareness of the important issues of U.S. foreign policy. The difference was between our speaker series and others was that we chose the topic first and then tried to find the country's top authority on that issue. And fortunately, the World Affairs Council and the American Jewish Committee agreed to co-sponsor the International Perspective Series. That was January 1999. Our first luncheon, held in a downtown hotel, drew 23 people. The second one, a month later, there were only 21 people, which made us wonder about its future. But now today, looking around this room, you can see how the program has grown. Every year, we've been able to feature distinguished professors addressing hot-button issues of U.S. foreign policy, and during that time, many of our speakers have become my close friends, like my dear friend, Charlie Kupchin. But after 18 years, I decided it was time for a change, time to bring new management onto the stage. Ray Termini, who could not be here today, will take the reins. He is a retired international real estate attorney, a super bright and articulate guy I know you will love. Ray secured the next three speakers in this year's series and will handle the program from now on. I express my appreciation for their many years' support to the wonderful folks at the World Affairs Council, especially Jim, Rachel, and Alana, and to Joel and Margot at the American Jewish Committee. Most of all, I have the deepest appreciation for folks like you in this audience who have followed us from the beginning, had faith in what we were doing, and as a result, have been enriched by a wider and more complete understanding of the world our country faces today. It's been fun and a great ride, and I thank you from the bottom of my heart.
Thank you, Mel. Thank you all for being here. And if you want to hear an interesting phone call tomorrow, I'll be speaking with President Fox at 10 o'clock for 30 minutes. So if you'd like to go on our website, you can register for that telephone call. We'll have a 7-second delay if needed. Thank you. Your chili's up here.